It is August 8th, 2017. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 655 of the Will Leach Experience Podcast on Sports on Earth. I am the aforementioned Will Leach. And thank you for spending part of your day with me. Very exciting times. Two podcasts this week, two podcasts last week. If you're back in the, remember the old days of this podcast when we had five a week? Good Lord. I can't believe that ever happened. I literally had five podcasts a week and five columns. I still do the five columns. Five podcasts. Whew, seems like a lot now. Anyway, I'm very delighted to have on as my guest today, Rafi Cohan. He's the author of the new book, The Arena, Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Writing, Dubiously Funded and Possibly Haunted, Monuments of American Sport. This is a terrific book, which is right up my alley because it is about stadiums and arenas and fields, kind of how they work, how they're funded, how they're put together. He kind of goes on a road trip and defines, goes to all these different stadiums. It's really a part travelogue, part investigative look at how stadiums work, part celebration of sports and of the games themselves. This is right up my alley as someone that is a bit of a stadium collector. I've talked in the past about how I am on sportspassport.com, which is a way to mark all of your games. I'm obsessed with that. So this is right my kind of book. It's a terrific book. It is out today wherever books are sold. The book is called The Arena. The author is Rafi Cohan, and he's going to talk to me right now. All right, sir. First off, thank you for doing this. The book is The Arena. I have to tell you, I mentioned in the intro, this is my kind of book. This is one of those books that while I was reading it, I had this sensation of, oh, wow, this is really good. I totally love this book. I'm really mad at this guy for writing it before I did. How are you, sir? It's pub day. It's Tuesday, August 8th. We're running this. It's pub day. How are you feeling on pub day? Are you feeling, are you excited? Are you buried under media requests and terrified? Refreshing your Amazon number. How are you hanging then?
Oh yeah, all of the above. I'm excited. I'm nervous. It feels like it would never come. You know, like a 3 years almost since, you know, first started thinking about it. But yeah, man, I'm really happy to be talking to you.
Yeah, don't do the Amazon number thing. They're down madness that path lies, I assure you. There's no good news that comes out of it. But nevertheless, I want to get down the basic premise of the book because, you know, one of my ballywicks, one of the things I love in the world, I'm a longtime proponent of this. I help out with sportspassport.com, which lets you mark in all the games that you go to and all the stadiums you go to. And so I love that. I love, like, I'm a proponent of going to games. I think we are sometimes in a culture where we get very comfortable in our homes and just want to watch games on television, and you cannot kind of beat that experience. What inspired you first off from the get-go to even do this project? Were you a season ticket holder of teams as a kid? Do you not like television? what was the push, or were you just looking for a way to go to as many stadiums as possible in a short amount of time? What was the idea?
Yeah, I mean, well, first of all, I definitely love television. Do not get the wrong idea.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, like you, I love going to games. I've always been a sports fan. I grew up in Northern Jersey. You know, so my teams were the Giants and Devils and Knicks and Yankees. The most games I went to was definitely for the Yankees. And it always really was kind of a special experience. I mean, it felt special for a lot of reasons. Going into New York, you know, felt sort of thrilling on its own. But then just also, you know, being around so many people was really exciting, you know, seeing the crowd sort of like crush through the gates and, you know, old Yankee Stadium where they were like stinky and sticky concourses that you had to wind your way through before you sort of turned into the vomitory and, you know, proceeded through out into the seating bowl where that first flash of green kind of hit you. And all of it was just such visceral experiences to me that it's always stuck with me. It's never really been just about the game for me, for going to, you know, I remember sitting out in the old bleachers with the bleacher creatures and like that felt like such an intimidating experience at first, you know, like, do I belong here? Will they welcome me? Will someone pour beer on my head? And it was just, you know, it was just so great that when I started thinking more about stadiums and like what kind of story I would want to tell around, you know, American stadiums in general, it was these other little underworlds or underappreciated worlds that, you know, maybe have been explored in little ways here and there, but I didn't think there was kind of like this tapestry, you know, book length, you know, exploration that had been done. So I thought I would do it before you did.
Yeah, jerk. yeah, because one of the things I love about stadiums too is it becomes like, you know, I always think of anytime you even watch a movie and like a downtown area is blown up, like stadium is always the first thing I look for. Like I remember in the Rock movie where there's a flood or a volcano or something, like they literally crash at AT&T Park and it made this the feeling that much stronger. And it's funny because it does feel, and you touched about this a little bit in the book, I wrote about this a couple weeks ago with the Rams football stadium. I know you end the book with this, but so we're not going narratively through your book linearly. Yeah. We'll just touching there. But one of the fascinating things I find about stadiums is when you are there, because they both like represent memory, but they're also, as you get across in the book, they're concrete things. They're infrastructures that have to be run, and you have to have people to run them. And it's always kind of amazing to me when one is abandoned, because it feels, particularly when it's still there. You know, there's a video online. Apparently, someone made a low budget movie called Silverdome. And apparently, just the trailer is online because this would be like just a guy and his buddies using iPhone cameras. But like they somehow got access to inside of the Silverdome. It's a story about how a football player lost his career and tries to come back and remember his career at the Silverdome. And it looks terrible and terribly acted and so on. But just the fact that it's inside this abandoned Silverdome gives it a pathos that makes me totally want to watch it, no matter what it's about. And I feel that way, like just the structure of the stadium and what it represents, more than just a game, more just a gathering place, but something for exists for among generations, which is why it's that much striking when it's something that is taken away, either torn down or even worse, kind of left standing as a ghost stadium.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so much of the history, you know, right, the emotion, the memory, it really does kind of like wrap itself in these buildings, you know, in the concourses, in the seats, in the clubhouses. And like you, when I found out that the Silverdome sold at auction, back in 2009, it just kind of blew my mind that somebody could own a stadium, I mean, it reminded me of like, you know, Little Big League or Rookie of the Year, you know, just like these kind of like 1990s PG rated comedies where, like, you know, you just somehow come into a stadium, or actually, further back, what is it, Brewster McCloud, right, who lives in Astrodome. It's so fanciful, and these buildings mean so much to us that it is super weird when they're just standing there, and the imagination kind of goes crazy. I think actually when they're left like that, they can drive people crazy. I mean, if you just see the fights that happen over them, you know, around the Silverdome, when that sold, it was like such a blow to the, you know, to the ego of that community, that like they like can't deal with it, that it's still there. Like at this point, they just want it down. They want it, you know, it's such a bad memory of, you know, the fact that this place represented putting Pontiac, Michigan on the map, you know, where, you know, the Who would come play, NFL played, and then all of a sudden it's just nothing. It's like, I was lucky enough to get a tour of the Silverdome. So even more amazing than standing outside and looking at this thing from, you know, beyond the barbed wire is actually walking into it, because you never really feel quite so small as when you're in an empty stadium. It's almost like it's like Honey, I Shrunk the Kids or something. Like, you're, you know, like the concourses never feel bigger. The ceilings never feel taller. The security guard who took me around that day, he told me a story about how he brought his dad there at one time when it was still operational after it sold. And they were setting up for some sort of concert. And there were, you know, tractor trailers on the other end of the stadium setting up the stage. And he turns, and his dad turns to him and says, you know, what's with all the toy trucks? It's like, you just lose all sense of perspective, and the imagination runs crazy, which is why, you know, they actually think it's haunted, the Silverdome. Right.
So one of the things you get into a little bit too, because it's strange that, and later on I want to ask you specifically how this relates to SunTrust Park, because I think it's a good example of how stadiums are today and how they've changed. But one of the amazing things to me is, you know, I've talked, my friend Tommy Craggs has this theory, he used to run Deadspin, that the best era for stadiums was actually the 70s.
Not
because those stadiums were the best or like they were most aesthetically pleasing, but they were the most useful. Like they actually were the best investments for the city. They might not have been the most lovely places to go to, but they got use out of them all the time. They were able to adapt, and they usually made, if they didn't make money for the city, they weren't as often as much as a loss leader for the city or the whatever municipality that paid for them. I'm curious, where do you fall on that line? You talk a lot in the book about how shady the finance is for a lot of these things. And of course, Field of Schemes is a famous website that says that very well as well. But like, also they still have this civic pride and they still look great. An idea. Like, how do you balance that between kind of the idea like, wow, this is this amazing thing that happened. Pity this poor county that will be paying for it for the next 50 years and losing jobs because of it.
Yeah. I've read that by Tommy. I think it was, I actually thought it was a really great, a great take. He's not wrong at all. Because, I mean, look, they were, I think most of these were like terrible places to actually see games, you know, sort of jack of all trades, master of none type situations. You know, like the sight lines were totally off. But in terms of like fiscal responsibility for the cities, they did pay off more. They did make more sense. But I mean, we're not going to get back to that. It's not going to happen. Like, I mean, we're not bringing back Shea Stadium. We're not bringing back Bush 2. At this point, I mean, what they're trying to do is they're trying to get more use out of the ones that we are paying for. They're trying to bring concerts into baseball stadiums, and they're trying to have, you know, bar mitzvahs at football stadiums. But it's, yeah, you know, the thing that really bothers me the most about the new wave is not so much that, well, it is that, we are getting sort of, we are getting screwed financially, but it's not just that. It's also that there's this seemingly this planned obsolescence for these places as well.
Right.
It's like we're taking no pride in these buildings, no long-term pride in them. Why would you build a new stadium for it to be outdated in 25 years or 15 years and then have a stadium battle for 10 years before you then, you build a new one in 25 to 30 years? If they are public buildings, then they should be public monuments in some ways. You know, they should be legacy buildings the same way that, you know, Bob Trumpor, who's a professor at Penn State and writes about stadiums, he compares, our stadiums, he calls them the new cathedrals. And they're kind of like old cathedrals or ornate train stations or, you know, skyscrapers. Like, these should be our buildings, the sort of mark we're making. And so what does it say about us when we're spending $500 million to $1.5 billion for a building whose main claim to fame is that it's new right now, and it's basically going to lose that, that singular cachet within 5 to 10 years. So yeah, that sucks.
Yeah, the idea, it's funny when you look at the 10 oldest, say, Major League Baseball stadiums, if you have Fenway and Wrigley, obviously, and then the Southern California stadiums, Dodger Stadium and Angel Stadium, then you got Oakland, which I can't wait to get rid of, Kauffman Stadium, which feels like permanently in the 70s, but like, maybe, but like otherwise the 10 oldest stadiums, you've got Toronto, Tampa, White Sox, and Camden Yards, which Yards was this time that was supposed to hark back to this time before, and now it actually is one of those 10 oldest stadiums, and the way it's going, maybe one of the top 7 or 8 oldest. And it's funny because I think about this. I've written a lot about the Atlanta Braves and kind of what they do with their minor league stadiums, where it's basically like a racket is what they do. Bloomberg wrote a great piece about this too, about how they will go. It's one thing to screw over Atlanta or to screw over Oakland with the stadium. But what the Atlanta will do, what the Braves will do, is they will go to like this town in Mississippi, like their monorail salesman, and be like, hey, who needs a new stadium? And like, I think they're 12 years into a 20-year lease that they know they're going to be out of, and they're still paying off the interest off the initial loan and closing schools. So it's always hard because I feel like this is, as a St. Louisan, as someone who's lived in St. Louis, as much as I would love for them to have a soccer stadium, and as much as I love kind of like the ideas that they had, I know what's best for the city.
Yeah.
But it is a thing though. I have a lot of friends in St. Louis that tell me, But man, it would be good to have something here. The town needs it. Downtown needs it. Yeah. I know that's not like the focus of your, but we certainly talk about that idea. The idea of,
yeah.
Do you invest any even either emotional capital or financial capital in the idea that these towns need this?
Yeah. Well, look. I mean, that's the winning argument, right? Is if enough people sort of feel that way. The thing ultimately where I landed on in terms of these is, and also, by the way, it's interesting that you bring up both minor league and soccer, because I think that those are kind of like the new fronts of the stadium war.
Yeah.
Because like as the bigger cities kind of get smarter, so let's go to the mid-sized cities and start playing them off of each other, which you're right. It feels even more galling. But, you know, ultimately, I think I think at this point we can say that all the evidence suggests that there is no financial benefit to building these stadiums. I mean, we're still being told that when they come up, for debate every time. There's some sort of like bogus, economic consultants who came up with a document which says it's going to be X amount of, economic activity. But I think we can all safely say that that's the case. So ultimately, if we can get to a place where we stop having that conversation and start having a conversation that says, okay, fine, we know it's not going to, benefit us in any way economically, and we should be smart enough then to also structure the deal in a way that we also don't, on the back end, start losing funding for things like schools or hospitals or roadways because it eats into the general fund because we have these optimistic forecasts, which are, complete bullshit. But let's start having the conversation around things like quality of life, civic pride, your friend in St. Louis who says we need this, wouldn't this be cool? Like, let's have that conversation.
Right.
And then if ultimately enough people within the city feel that, yes, that we want to pay for that quality of life, that civic pride, let's have a referendum on it. Let's not just go to the city council and shut voters out of it. But if that's what people decide, then we can't complain. If we're deciding that like we want to invest or not even invest, but spend our money in this, like we would a golf course or an arts district, knowing that it needs to be subsidized, not just one time, but probably over time continuously. And yes, it's a form of corporate welfare. And yes, the lease agreement is going to be structured in such a way that you get screwed over and the team gets more, way more of the revenue than they probably deserve, aside from the fact that, it's a monopoly and therefore can do what they want, then fine. Then, okay, we can have that conversation. But when we have towns setting up these, these sort of the funding structures in such a way where it can potentially close a hospital like it did in Cincinnati or start eating to general funds and taking away from schools, or even if it's a sin tax, which is what they did in Cleveland, taxing things like cigarettes and alcohol, which disproportionately affects, lower income folks, like that also seems not fair. So let's be real about like what they cost, and then decide if that's something we want. Because we're never going to change the fact that they're going to be able to shake down cities for these things. They are.
Yeah, we're getting way too serious now because this book is really fun. I want to talk about some of the fun things that you have in there. I'm a longtime obsession because one of the things that's really fun about the book is that you really dig into like scoreboard operators and mascots. And as I one of my favorite podcasts I ever did was I had the Red Panda Acrobat on the halftime show, who with the balancing of the plates, like literally one of the most amazing things I've ever seen in person. I can't remember an athletic achievement I've ever seen that's more impressive than what the Red Panda does. It's really just amazing to me. But you really kind of get into like the actual infrastructure of putting these games on, and I'm always kind of fascinated. I actually have a friend of mine that's worked at the New Bush Stadium since it opened, and it's funny, every time I talk to him, I remember he jokes that he said when they built the place they spared every expense. So which is always makes me worried every time I hear something crack or crumble, the whole thing's going to collapse. But like, I feel like you can find so much out about a stadium, and not just a stadium, but the people that live in the town that stadium is in, just by talking to the people that have worked there forever.
Yeah, no question. I mean, that's kind of one of the right untold stories of stadiums, I thought, was actually right, like the sort of humans that, toil behind the scenes or in the concourses, I mean, they sort of see us, you know, us being sports fans, you know, at kind of our best, at our worst, yeah. You know, like sitting up in the command center. I went to I was out in San Diego there for a couple of reasons for the book. And actually it was sort of by chance, because, you know, this is a long way of saying that I sat in the command center where they sort of oversee everything related to security. And I went into this, you know, this whole project thinking I would love to get a behind the scenes on stadium security. Because of all those places that, like you're saying, that are, you know, kind of get this sort of look into this manifestation of who we are via the stadium, I figure the people who deal with the drunks and, you know, breaking up fights or cleaning up vomit are the ones who get the most. And I didn't think anyone was going to allow me to do it. And then I was in San Diego and they said, yeah, why not? Go ahead. I hope they don't regret that. but you know, I was sitting up in this command center and they literally have, I mean, it's very Big Brother-ish, but they have cameras pointing everywhere in the stadium, in the hallways, in the stands, even outside the stadium. And it's amazing sort of like the influx of activity that happens at once. When a home run ball got hit, and you know, by the, I think they were playing the Rockies that day, and a fan threw it back, we like zoomed in on the guy in right field, and you could basically see like the size of his soda and like, you know, how much perspiration was coming off of the cup. And another point, we were a couple of surfer bums sort of like, you know, set up shop outside the stadium. And they, one of the guy who's working the camera asked John Leese, who was their head of security at the time, hey, John, you want these guys setting up camp here? They were drinking a couple 40s. John says, no. They send out a couple of patrol officers, actual police officers. The guys hide their liquor bottle. And then as they come up, you hear the sort of representative from the police station say into their ear, yeah, you know, number 43, it's under their blanket. And they, so the officers demand the bottle from under the blanket. And you see these guys look around like some sort of like mystical black magic has just, you know, just been conducted. Sorry, I don't know if that totally answered your question in terms of, sort of these behind the scenes of the logistic, but it is, I mean, it, each of them, the thing that maybe surprised me the most in terms of this book was kind of the extent to which each of these little worlds, each of these areas were like so fully realized in and of themselves, right? From, you know, from the security world to like groundskeeping to, like you said, the, you know, the halftime performers. I spend a huge amount of time with this guy, the amazing Slotek, and I think I formed a similar kind of bond with him, like psychically, than the first time I saw him perform, like you did with Red Panda. And like the more you sort of scratched the surface and the deeper you dug, you just realized like you had no idea what went into all this stuff. And I personally, you know, had no idea like where it would bring me, like physically, literally where it would bring me. You know, at one point I was hanging out with the Braves grounds crew. It was still at Turner, obviously. And the next thing I know, I'm on like 100 miles long road trip to the Redneck Riviera in Alabama to go visit a sod farm, which, you know, it just was one of those things I never thought about. I never thought like, where is grass grown for a stadium? It just never occurred to me. And, you know, there's all these little rabbit holes you can just kind of fall into.
Yeah, and it's funny, you touched on this before. I'm always kind of fascinated how these teams are really their own ecosystems, their own, like everything, they're self-contained and everyone finds their own rules. And one of the things I find fascinating that you dig into this book is the idea of ticket scalping. And in this universe, I'm currently trying to find a ticket for the Georgia-Notre Dame game that is, I'm just checking every day, like $650, my God. but it is fascinating to me because, you know, I remember when I was a kid, I would go and, you know, we needed a couple of tickets to the game. My dad would nod at some guy and he'd nod back. And it just felt like this like back alley deal for this from this farm kid in the big city. But now it is its own self-contained ecosystem with from the internet and the people at the games all kind of fighting each other.
Yeah, I mean, unfortunately, yeah, I mean, I never, that was another world that I never really considered, sort of how rich it was on its own was ticket scalping. And in some ways it was an area that kind of just intimidated me a little bit, because it was kind of it's a marginal world. It's a, it's sort of like this side economy that exists is like a barnacle on a ship to the stadium. And you can kind of walk past it, but never even times when I have gotten a ticket from one of these guys, it feels a little illicit. And I never, obviously I never spent more time with them than that. But I mean, it's a really evolving world. It's like a fast evolving world, and largely because of what you said in terms of the internet versus sort of the on the ground economy. I mean, one interesting stat that I learned was, in 2010, it was something like 60 to 70% of the secondary ticket market existed outside of sports venues. And as of 2015, it was like 15 to 20%. I mean, that's huge. That's a huge chunk of the market that's now just completely disappeared. And the guys will tell you, I mean, they feel it big time. The two places where I specifically spent time were around in the Gateway District in Cleveland, which is Progressive Field and Quicken Loans Arena, and then around Fenway Park. And they all kind of had like the same kind of story, which was, the halcyon days of ticket scalping are over. And now, it's just this much more kind of grinded out economy. And actually, in Fenway, they call it grinding. They don't call it scalping, because you're grinding. It's you buy one, you sell it. You buy one, you sell it. The guy Jimmy, I spent the most time with there, like that was he would give me sort of like little asides while I was, hanging out with him, little lessons. And one of them was, never hang on to a ticket for too long. Like some guys, he says, fall in love with a ticket. Like, this ticket should be worth this, and I'm not going to sell it until I get this for it. And then by the end of the day, you've lost any opportunity to sell it, because you were too precious about what you wanted to sell it for. He had a good line, which was why one ticket was worth one thing versus another. He just said, "An ice cream has no bones, so what?" And you got to move on from the ticket. But these guys, they were, Jimmy, just as an example, he started scalping tickets when he was about 15 in 1985 around Fenway and the Boston Garden. And he was making like $1,500 a night, all cash, living the high life, going out, drinking, drugs, women, the whole thing. And then it's like slowly, lots of little things have sort of chipped away at maybe this glorious memory of he has of himself as a teenager, starting with, ticket scalping suddenly becoming legal in a way that it wasn't legal before. There's no federal law against ticket scalping. It's all sort of by state or municipality. And in Boston, it was around 1999 or 2000 that it became legal. Then suddenly all the guys who didn't want to take like a walkie-talkie to the face from a cop patrolling the beat, or get arrested, now they could suddenly come on and come down, and they flood the market in that way. Then, when the internet comes in, it starts taking a little bit away from it as well. I mean, if I can look at my phone and I can see the price of what a bleacher seat is going for, and it's $10 less than what you're asking for, then why am I gonna buy it from you? And also, maybe I just also don't want to interact with you. I mean, I know we go to these stadiums. It's one of these last places we actually go for like public gatherings and like communion in that way. But at the end of the day, we're all becoming a little bit more introverted and like behind Netflix and on demand, everything. So maybe I just don't want to talk to you. And also, there's the digital ticket market is taking over. A lot of teams, right, are going all digital. And that's killing the scalpers. So these guys are really struggling to make it now in a way that they, before it was this kind of like almost like outlaw, cool, Wild West profession.
It's funny, and this is why I want to use the example of SunTrust Park before I start asking you a couple opinion questions. SunTrust Park is the newest Major League Baseball stadium. It is in suburban Atlanta, essentially, and which came up with a lot of discussion, the idea that like most places are going more toward the downtown model and they're going toward that model. But it's funny, I like the stadium. I think aesthetically it's better than Turner Field. The sight lines are better. It's a pleasant experience, but it feels so modern in so many ways that it feels like it has the problem that you kind of touched on earlier, which is the idea that it's almost built in with an end date. You know, it's got every kind of trend in ballparks now. It's got a place with a celebrity chef, as you talk about in the book as well. Hugh Atchison has a gourmet hot dog place in there, and there's a climbing wall for the kids, and all the tickets are digital, and everything that you kind of expect, which is really fun. But I feel like whenever the new trends come in 10 or 15 years, which they will, because they're constantly building stadiums, there's nothing classic about it. And there is something about a stadium that, even if you're just almost trying to conjure up the nostalgia of classicism, it's in there somewhat. And I find SunTrust Park, as nice it is, and I do like going there, I don't like getting to there because it's off a terrible road. But once you're there, it's a very pleasant experience. But it feels disposable in a way that I don't think ballparks are supposed to feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what we were talking about earlier in terms of, you know, right, the idea that like these should be more legacy buildings, like they should feel, if we're paying for these stadiums, we're building these stadiums, let's build something that feels like it should last, or at least has a chance to last. Yeah, I went to SunTrust Park a few weeks ago, and I share your opinions on it. I mean, I had a great time. The burgers at Holman and Finch are amazing. The fact that you can go to the Terrapin Tap Room and buy a $6 beer and bring it back into the stadium is super cool. The thing is that so like everyone else is doing these downtown stadiums, and whether they're doing it for like targeted revitalization or just because like that's if it's a place like Wrigley, where they're also kind of redoing that whole area. That's just where they have to do it. But it also, I think it actually speaks to another trend, which is the idea of controlling the experience, right? They're like, the team does not want a lot of external factors. When I walked up to SunTrust Park, I was looking for the ticket scalpers, right? Like, I mean, now that when I go to games, like I'm looking for different things now after writing the book, and like spending time in all these different areas. I have different expectations of like what for me like a day at the park would be like. I wanted to kind of buy a ticket from a scalper. There were no scalpers. Yeah. And it makes sense. I imagine that there's much less walk up traffic, you know, because there's not really great public transportation. It's off highways. There's like nothing really around it except for that kind of like corporate like retail park. And so they're completely controlling the experience, like everything, like they're capturing all of the dollars that are spent there. And when you go there, it's less like a baseball park in the mode of even like Camden or Target Field. And it's much more of like baseball amusement park. Mm-hmm. It's been put through the like Disney grinder. And like this is kind of the like very sanitized version of baseball. I want some, you know, you think you want to get your uniform dirty out on the field. I want to get my uniform dirty in the stands. I want to feel a little bit of edge. I want to feel like the building has, has some character to it too. And I don't know what it is. What is it? I don't know if Will, if you have a thought on this, what is it that gives that makes a new building feel like it has a chance to last? Because, you know, they're all going to look kind of the same, especially when they're all being built by populace. But like, where does the character come from? I mean, what is it that gives the, like, what, you've been to so many parks, which ones to you do you think will be around in 30 years?
Well, it's funny, you bringing this up, you reminded me of, When I lived in New York from 2000 to 2013, and one of my good friends, AJ Deloria, was a big diehard Phillies fan. So we would always go to Phillies games every year, and went to Veterans Stadium. And Veterans Stadium, I mean, did you ever go to Veterans Stadium?
I never went to Veterans. No.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it felt like, people talked about like Philly fans being crazy, but it really felt like you were visiting like your uncle's kind of ratty attic. You know, it just felt like, and there was something dangerous, and you had to be really careful because you'd knock something over and break it, or you'd hurt yourself, or you'd catch something. And it just felt, but it felt exciting. You talked about having like a little bit of edge. Like that's what Veterans Stadium felt like to me. It felt like it had edge. And I remember I went to the first game at Citizens Bank Park with AJ, and we both talked about how weird it was. It felt like being at your grandmother's house where she spent like 3 years to take the cover off the couch to make sure nobody spilt anything on it. And that's still what a lot of these stadiums feel like to me. They feel like they're not like a glove that you haven't worked in, or you haven't pounded in yet. And that's what it feels like to me. But it's funny, compare, say, Citizens Bank Park, which I think still has that feeling, even though it's 13 years old. I guess it's mostly empty now. Maybe that has something to do with it. But compare that to, say, PNC Park. Like PNC Park in Pittsburgh feels instantly iconic. Like there are stadiums that are older, that are younger than PNC Park, like Citizens Bank Park, like Nationals Park, that feel like they're going to be replaced before PNC Park is replaced. Like PNC Park feels like a place that's going to be around forever. And a part of that, and I would argue, this kind of cuts back to our SunTrust Park idea, I would argue it's because it feels ingrained into the city itself. It feels almost inextricable from the city. Whereas you could pick up SunTrust Park and pick up the little restaurants and stuff out, they call it the Battery outside center field, the fake skyline that they've kind of built out there. You can pick that up and put that anywhere in the country and have the same experience. But PNC Park has to be there where it is. So it feels like PNC Park is going to be around for 60 years. And I feel like I can't say that for a lot of the new parks. So that's probably the way that I would think about it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you know, it's interesting when, as you talked about sort of the Veterans Stadium, one guy I read was John Williams. He's this British sociologist. He had an essay in a book called The Stadium and the City. And he was talking about stadiums, and this was written over 20 years ago at this, but he was talking about how stadiums have kind of become Disneyfied in the way we were just talking about, in the way that like it's Epcot Center. It literally could be anywhere. And he sort of had this thought experiment, which I thought was really fun, which is, why do we need this? Like, why can't we just strip it back? Like, why do we require all these kinds of bells and whistles, you know, for stadiums, for ballparks, that we don't require for the experience of like going hunting? Like when you go hunting, like you're expecting to get dirty, you're expecting to like piss in the woods, you know, you're not expecting to have like a fancy hot dog stand, like waiting around the next bluff. But for games, that's somehow the calculus on that has changed completely. I mean, obviously a big part of that is the fact that teams, you know, have, you know, they see these as revenue opportunities. So they're not going to strip it back in that way. But like, wouldn't it be awesome if just like one team said, screw it. Like, I'm just going to build metal bleacher benches. We're going to serve you hot dogs and we're going to be like dicks about it. And, you know, and like you're going to come and you're going to watch the game. And if you don't like that, then you're not going to come watch the game. Like, you're not a hunter. It's okay. Like, hunting. Like the rest of us are going to go hunting. And not that, and like, you know, it's not going to happen. But that's something I sort of like fantasize about.
Well, not even minor league stadiums will do that anymore. No. Like even minor league stadiums are all like the fancy experience now.
Especially because now the fact that they're shaking down these medium sized cities for the money, they have to. You have to get like if it's going to cost $150 million to build a ballpark for like the Pawtucket Red Sox or whatever, then like there better be some fancy, you know, some fancy fancy ornamentation to go along with that. Although also to be fair, the minor leagues, like
they got to bring them in. They don't have the stars.
They got to put on a show. I mean, that's why, you know, like all those fun promotions and weird wacky stunts are all minor league. Not that it has to be done in a $150 million ballpark. Obviously, that's ridiculous. But I sort of get it a little bit more, at least from that point of view.
You know, we've talked mostly about baseball, but I find it funny because, you know, when it comes to like specifically football and basketball, football, particularly the NFL, we've talked about like making the experience easier. I feel like the NFL has actually not gone that direction. The NFL is you can't bring a bag larger than your wallet and don't and don't make eye contact with anyone as you go into the, like, the NFL has doubled down on these things, and to where I don't understand why someone, I love watching baseball at home, but for me, the experience of watching a baseball game in person is always going to be an improvement on watching it at home. And so, and I don't understand how someone could argue accordingly other than saying, well, I think tickets are too expensive. But other than that, the experience itself in a financial neutral situation is better. Whereas with the NFL, particularly when you get to some of the, like the terrible, more terrible stadiums like Washington's and just like these awful kind of corporate experience. To me, I do understand when it comes to the NFL why someone would say, you know what, screw it. Screw it, I can watch this. The product itself is so based toward television that the in a way, fans are just extras on a soundstage anyway. So, like, for me, I feel like if there's one thing where the in-person experience has suffered the most, it's probably football.
Completely. It's, I mean, they're... I think that the stadiums that draw the most for football now are kind of, or not draw the most, but the ones that kind of like have the most cachet in terms of people wanting to go there. I mean, I don't know if any of the new ones are trumping AT&T Stadium. Like, well, let's wait and see what happens when Mercedes-Benz Stadium opens in Atlanta. But right, it almost becomes more of like a tourist destination. Like, you're going for like the experience of just going there once, you know, to say that you've been there, to say that you've seen the spectacle. It's a total pain in the ass to go to these games. I mean, the guys, so I hung out with like the control room guys, you know, the ones who run the Jumbotron, you know, that's one of the things that they're super aware of, is that even on like the most basic level, in terms of like, there's not an announcer who can tell you, well, if you look at number 73, kind of clearing out this block, you know, that like they need to show replays that like, you know, that sort of that mimic the TV experience and make it clear, because otherwise fans are like just like totally in the dark in terms about what's happening. And there's all that dead time in between plays. I mean, the only reason I can understand why people go to games is if, you know, I don't know, you have some sort of like family or friend tradition around
tailgating. Right.
You know, and like, and it's really not even about the game. I mean, how many people go to games and don't, you know, to tailgate and don't actually go into the stadium? It's not an insignificant number. Around Penn State, they've done some research on it, and it's something like 25% of people that show up for games never go into the stadium. They're just there for sort of that experience of the tailgating and drinking, you know, hanging out with friends, catching up, all that stuff. I get it from that perspective, but you're right. And the NFL seems to be making it harder sort of in every which way. I don't know what their motivation is. I mean, to be honest, anytime I reached out to the NFL for comments for this book, I didn't get a lot of response.
I know that feeling.
So I can't tell you sort of where they're coming from, but it sort of is in line with their general kind of, you know, entitled above it all, you know, perspective that like, you're going to take this football and you're going to like it. And
to quote the God Save Pod Save America podcast, repeal and go fuck yourself. It's kind of the general NFL's attitude on a lot of these things. And I think that works for now. We'll see moving forward.
Yeah. I mean, isn't it? It's such a short term strategy to treat your fans like shit. Like, I don't know that you need a consultant to tell you that, but if you do, perhaps they can send us a check.
Yes, exactly. Okay, my last question, because I had a blast talking to you about this. I'm curious, just like emotionally speaking, personally, because, you know, people always ask me what my favorite stadium to go to, and my answer is always Busch Stadium 3, not because I actually think it's the best stadium, but because it feels like home. Like, it's like, you know, I get there and it's my place, and I know it well, and so that's my favorite, though I don't actually think it is my favorite stadium. What is your favorite stadium to go to, both emotionally and I think, and like maybe intellectually and architecturally?
Yeah. I really envy you the fact that you've been able to
adjust. Yeah, because you got Yankee Stadium.
Able to adjust. I mean, that's a transition that I have not been able to make with new Yankee Stadium.
Well, your new stadium sucks. That's part
it
of the problem.
Sucks. It's brutal. I went to a game I think 2 weeks ago, and it was just like every sort of like touch point of like fan interaction was just terrible. I mean, you know, like getting there 10 minutes before first pitch and literally missing the first whole inning before I was even able to get into the stadium because it was just like a jumble of people. And now, you know, I'm thinking logistically, I'm like, what a garbage, you know, what a garbage way to treat your fans. But yeah, I have not been able to make that transition. Maybe it's because I went to old Yankee Stadium so much. And I've kind of slowed up a little bit, you know, since new Yankee Stadium has opened, but it doesn't feel like it's homey. It feels more sort of like corporate NFL-y in that way, that like, we're happy to have your money here. But like we could take or leave you. and so emotionally, maybe my favorite stadium really is Fenway Park. I lived in Boston for a time. And in some ways, like, I mean, I can sort of do like psychic, contortions to kind of convince myself that by going to Fenway, I'm kind of connecting to like Yankee history too, because so much, you know, of like Yankee tradition is still tied up within Fenway. And it really is a beautiful park. They've really done a great job in terms of like negotiating like the renovations and like modernity versus history, all that kind of stuff. It's not maybe the most amazing in terms of like modern sort of like architectural ambitions or anything like that. I don't know if you've been to AT&T Stadium in Arlington.
Yeah,
that's the one that's just blown me away. And I don't know what maybe it's the fact that it just like you're driving out and it's sort of like flat on flat Texas roads and it just kind of like slowly emerges on the horizon. And like to me, it looks like sort of like a crouched futuristic Ninja Turtle, just like ready to spring into action. And then going inside there was just, I mean, both on the day of the game, taking tours, like I really kind of never wanted to leave it. It just felt like, and not because it felt like home, but it just felt like very welcoming. Again, like once you paid your entry fee, you know, it still cost $25 to take a tour. But it was just, it was really cool. There was like so many like gadgets. There were, I spoke to the lead architect of AT&T Stadium, a guy named Mark Williams, and he was saying that he was there one game and he watched like a father and a son kind of just like looking at the size of a bolt, like on one of the beams. And it's like a bolt the size of a bowling ball. And like the kid was having an experience of like wrapping his head around this bolt, thinking like, if the bolt is that big, how big must the wrench be? You know? It's just, you know, it's one of those places that kind of makes you question everything in that way. Like, how big can this place really be? And the answer is really big. Let me tell you one quick story, which wasn't in the book, but I think you'll get a kick out of. So I got some, in addition to sort of like the paid tours at AT&T Stadium, I was finally able to convince the Cowboys to give me an official sort of behind the scenes tour, both with the guy like on an art tour because they have all these like modern artworks there, and then also with their head of engineering, which was super cool because that was really like underneath the hood kind of stuff, like seeing the 11,000 tons of air conditioning, the chiller plants, you know, everything in those as far as that goes. But I was, you know, I kept sort of asking him, like, what are the quirks? What are the, like, what's, like, this is, if this is a, you know, a perfectly constructed stadium, like, what would you change? What sort of weird things happened here? So finally, he told me about this drainage test that they ran when the stadium first opened called the Super Flush. I don't know if that was actually its name or if that's what they call it. But basically, they turned on all the faucets. They flushed all the toilets at once. So they got... So everything in the building was running. He said it was 5,000 gallons per minute on both sides of the stadium. So they're like, all right, the stadium is good to go. Bring the people in. But then, weirdly enough, there were all of these like smells, you know, that came during early events. Clogs. He's like, what the hell's going on? And it turns out that all of the pipes in the luxury suites in particular were suffering clogs. And he's like, why? What's going on there? So they went, you know, they snaked it all out. And everyone was flushing their underwear down the toilet in Cowboys luxury suites. I don't know why. I don't know what that says about them, but
I feel like this has to be somehow Chris Christie related. It has to be somehow Chris Christie related.
Would still be fishing out those underwear.
Yes, yes. Oh, that's amazing. Well, I gotta tell you, I absolutely love the book. The book is called The Arena, Inside the Tailgating, Ticket Scalping, Mascot Racing, Jubilee Funded, and Possibly Haunted, Monuments of American Sport. As you can tell from my chat with Rafi here, I love this book. Seriously, great luck with it, man. I'm still a little mad at you for writing it before I did, but nevertheless, great job. I wish you all the luck with it. Thanks for chatting with me.
Thank you so much, Will.
All right, so everyone, go buy the book, The Arena by Rafi Cohen. We'll be back with another podcast this week. Music by the Sundogs. Rate and review us on iTunes. Have a great week. Buy the book. I'm holding the book up right now to the microphone. I know this is a podcast and this is a dumb thing, but I'm pretending that I am David Letterman pointing to the book, The Arena, because it's a good book. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Pavement. All right, have a great week, everyone. We'll be back later this week. Buy the book. Bye.